food connects and it just continues on and on and on. That's the power of food. When clients come to me, they know what they're getting. I am unique in what I do. My style is unique. How I view the restaurant is unique, and they come to me for that.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, really awesome conversation. I'm interviewing Mika McCook. Now, Mika is a food photographer. Now, you know, I've had all kinds of people on in the world of food, whether it's chefs, whether it was the creator of diners, drive-ins, and dives. You know, food is just such a huge thing that, I mean, it's culture. It brings people together. You can tell a lot about a culture just by the food and the things that they incorporate in it, all kinds of cool stuff. So when I saw, Mika and her story on being a photographer, that not just the cooking and the seasoning and the plating and the preparing and the eating part of food, but trying to convey kind of the uniqueness and the culture of food through photography, I thought was going to be a really cool conversation. It certainly was. I think you're going to really, really enjoy this conversation. You know, we talk a lot about photography. We talk about some of the coolest things she's been a part of. You know, she used to work a lot with restaurants and making sure that their menu was displaying food in a way that made people want to order it. But she's kind of moved into kind of the corporate world now of taking pictures of dishes for, corporations and, their magazines, all that kind of stuff. You know, we talked about something that I wanted to know about, which is, I've heard in the past that, trying to make food look good, that it's not always food, whether they're putting, styrofoam in it or putting glass for ice and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to ask about that. And she answered that question. And I think that you're going to really be interested in that answer. Mika was a really, really amazing person. I think you're really, really going to enjoy this one. If you haven't already, your first time listening, or you just haven't, after listening, or hey, do it right now, go follow along on Instagram, on Spotify, on TikTok, on Apple. I mixed those all together, but Not Enough Podcast on Instagram and on TikTok. And then, of course, wherever you're listening, I really appreciate you giving that 5-star rating and leaving a written review on Apple. It really helps a ton. But here is Mika McCook. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Good. I think it was too many, like an M and a C together. I started tripping up trying to say your name, but we're gonna do all right. Just introduce yourself. I struggled, but maybe you'll do a little bit better.
Well, believe it or not, the name that I was given at birth, I struggle with it sometimes too. But my name is Mika McCook, and I'm a food photographer based in Austin, Texas.
I love that. And I want to kind of just dive right into that. So food photography, I think everyone in the world at this point feels like they're a food photographer. A family member likes to joke, that we can't eat until Instagram eats with, all my family wanting to take pictures. So what does that mean exactly to be a food photographer?
Well, it can mean a lot of things. But when I first started to be a food photographer, I worked closely with a lot of restaurants. So in that realm, hospitality, and people often confused me for a food influencer. And so I had to clear that up and say, well, no, which is a whole other branch in itself, but I worked with restaurants and helped bring their website up to date, their social media up to date. If they got any publications featured, they often wanted photos. So they want the best of the best photos that they could give to these publications. And that changed in 2020 when I switched from working with mainly restaurants to doing more commercial work. So now when I tell people I'm a food photographer, they automatically think still food influencer. And I say, no, I work with food brands and it's a much different world. So there's a lot of trickery. There's a lot of sorcery. It is stressful at times. The types of, shots that you're doing, you have a day to get all of it together. But if I could sum up everything of what it means to be a food photographer, it really is, you know, wearing two kinds of hats, a creative hat and a business hat. And you're just going from gig to gig to gig to gig. So it's constant movement.
Yeah, and we're going to unpack that, but I want to kind of start right at the beginning of what you were saying. And that was when you were working mainly with restaurants, because I feel like, you know, you don't really notice when in menus, when people are doing a fine job, you notice when they've taken pictures of their food and it looks awful, whether it's clearly a stock photo that every restaurant in the world uses that same photo, or maybe even worse, I don't know whether they, you know, they took a picture of it on a styrofoam foam plate in the basement or what, but people just take awful pictures sometimes. So what was that like? And I mean, how did you, I guess my understanding or my idea, and correct me if I'm wrong, would be when it comes to magazines, it maybe the job didn't get easier, but the expectation of what it's going to look like maybe got a little easier. And I feel like working directly with restaurants, they would have a harder time understanding exactly what it was going to take to make a good product. Did you deal with that a lot where the restaurants are just like, you know, I made this sandwich, take a picture of it, get in the menu and everything should be fine?
Yes. With the smaller restaurants, the smaller mom and pops, because they've never worked with a food photographer. And when I ask them questions like, what do you want your customers to feel when they walk into your restaurant? Or what do they feel when they eat your food? Or what are some things that people have said, adjectives in Google reviews that you've read? And that throws them off because they're like, you just need to take a picture. Like, what are we doing with all of these feelings? And then as we go deeper into the shoot itself, they began to understand why I ask those questions. And so the first time that they work with a food photographer, at least with me, I don't know how other food photographers, you know, work with their clients. But for me, I ask a lot of feeling questions. How does your customer feel? What's the environment like? What's the vibe like? And after that, they have a clearer idea of what to say when they book another food photographer or when they book me again. They have a clear understanding of their brand. And most small restaurants don't have a brand. They have a loose idea of like, oh, we're going to use a sandwich shop. I'm a sandwich shop. But it goes so much further than just being a sandwich shop, because there's 1,000 other sandwich shops. What's special about your sandwich shop? What do people experience when they go to your place? And so it is a struggle when I first work with small and pop, mom and pop shops. Now, bigger restaurants, chain restaurants that have a budget, they have a team that already have this. And so they give me what's called a treatment or a spec or a mood board. And it tells me, this is our brand, this is our restaurant, these are the colors that we associate with, these are the types of dishes we want our target customer to be, this person. So we want to create photos that will attract that. And so one sandwich shop that is like a family oriented place, well, they're not going to want to appeal to the 20-something year old who wants to take an Instagram selfie. So we're not going to take types of images for that. They want something that's family. So there's a lot of kids involved. There's red baskets involved. So it surprises them how much psychology is involved before the actual photography takes place. And with smaller restaurants, I do have to hold their hand and guide them through. And with larger brands, it's very cut and dry, direct, and I don't have to ask a lot of questions because they already have them answered. It's just more about logistics of team, budget, things like that.
No, I love kind of the introduction of thinking about feelings, because I mean, food definitely does bring feelings to people, whether it's just the experience of going out, whether it is, you know, the feelings of grandma's special recipes. I mean, it's a huge thing. I've interviewed quite a few people in the food world. I've interviewed so many different people, but I was just thinking before we started about kind of, I always try to think of the people that I've interviewed in the same type of topics. You know, I interviewed the creator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. I interviewed a food historian, several different chefs. And we always kind of talk a little bit about how, you know, food, I mean, food is culture. I mean, it's you can look at the food of the United States and really see kind of the diverse cultures that have blended everything together to make what we have now. But also just about how much food brings people together. We promised not to talk politics and we're not going to, but I will. The only thing I'll say is if everyone just sat down and shared a meal, I think that would go a long way. So talk to us a little bit about, I guess, the importance of food. That's a really tall task, but.
Well, yes. I mean, when we talk about feelings and food, you really do think about what makes an emotion. When someone says, I'm happy, well, what does happy look like? When someone says, I want a feeling of nostalgia, well, what does that look like? And people don't think about that until they're well presented with that challenge. And for me, it's never been a challenge to break down emotions because of my background in theater and as a playwright. My entire educational background was focusing on feelings and describing that without using the word angry and or sad or in love. Like, what does in love look like? There's a lot of actions to that. And so when it comes to food, I think the reason why it's such a powerful thing is because of how much is involved and how many different hands are involved. I mean, when you think about it, you know, the chef or recipe developer creates the recipe and they perfect it, and maybe they'll test it out on a couple of their friends and they'll ask for their friends' feedback and what they experience and what they taste, and everything is different. And then you present it to the world, and maybe people will love it. There's always going to be one person who doesn't like something. But what makes it so wonderful is you get so many different people giving so many different, you know, levels of feedback. When you talk to someone, for example, who's from Austin, Texas, apparently we're unicorns. I don't think so, but we are. There's a chain. It's not a chain, but it's a local burger joint called Sandy's. And anyone who was born and raised in Austin will know what Sandy's is. But every single person has a different feeling to describe it. For me, I'm so in tune and it is so close to my heart that I'm just loyal. And I look at Sandy's and I go, that's Austin. That's unique. That's weird. That's this. But I've never been to Sandy's on any day other than Tuesday and Thursday because of their special, or not Tuesday and Thursday and Saturday are their burger specials. So any other day of the week, I don't know what Sandy's is like because I've never been there on any other day of the week. And if you talk to another Austinite, they'll say, oh, their burgers are trash. And I will never eat that, but I love their ice cream cones. They're, you know, the chocolate and vanilla ice cream swirls, and everyone has something different to say about it. But collectively, we all know about Sandy's. We all know that this is Austin. And if Sandy's were to close, there would be so many people sad and disappointed to have such a staple location, part of Austin's history, to be shut down. So it's just wonderful how that one restaurant food connects all of these local Austinites, and it just continues on and on and on. That's the power of food. That's what makes food blogs so powerful. That's what makes YouTube videos powerful, and even food influencers, even with their crappy photos, what is appealing to that is that there's genuineness. I don't know if that's a word, but I'm going to use it. It's genuine. It's real. People are more inclined to believe a raw iPhone photo than they will my photo, which is meant to attract. It's a little net. It's a spider's web. It's supposed to attract people. So yes, I create the perfect lighting situation. We perfectly style it for the camera. It's meant to go on a website. It's meant to be on a print, but someone's iPhone is to show, this is my experience eating here. This is my experience making this recipe. And what you see is what you get. So there's like different ways of how food brings us together, but how people find their way to it.
Let's talk about the world of influencing now, just because, you know, I just wonder, has your type of job gotten easier or harder? People know more about, you know, the world of, you know, I guess food photography, but that doesn't mean they know good photography. I'm just thinking in Indianapolis, you know, we're not a huge city, but we are relatively large and big enough that I can think of three restaurants now that kind of in their blurb, you know, in their, on their pages, you know, we have Instagram worthy foods. Like they set up their plates just to try to make them good to take pictures of. Do you think that that's helped your world because people appreciate, you know, food photography more, or has it hurt it because now everyone thinks that they know what's going on and that's not always the case?
Well, I don't think that it's hurt my business at all, my workplace at all, because they are using a phone, they are influencing, they are marketing. It's a whole different world. And when clients come to me, they know what they're getting. I am unique in what I do. My style is unique. How I view the restaurant is unique. And they come to me for that. As opposed to a food influencer, their job is to get people in the restaurant. And they primarily use video to accomplish that. Videos all over. I shoot stills. Maybe I'll do a stop motion, but really my power is in photography. So no, I don't feel threatened. I think it's great for food influencers and anybody who thinks that they can be a food photographer, because you can be a food photographer. There are different levels. There's a budget for every photographer. I truly believe that. But the more successful that a restaurant is, the more they'll have enough revenue to hire someone like me, because my budget is a lot higher. To hire me and someone like me, it's an investment. That's another thing that a lot of, at least beginner restaurants, are shocked. They're shocked by the cost. They're like, oh my God. And they don't understand that there's a team involved. It's not just me showing up with my camera. It's me and a food stylist. It's me and my assistant. And we're working together to bring this elevated idea of your restaurant. And a food influencer's job is to elevate on that, to bring people to see that. They're two very different worlds. And often food influencers do transition from being a food influencer to working with restaurants because a restaurant will see their photos, which was, I guess, kind of the case for me. I mean, I never considered myself an influencer. When I started food photography, I honestly started because I started a food blog with a friend of mine, and I wanted to learn everything about food photography. I couldn't care less about the cooking. Like, that was not my thing, recipe development, all of that. So I never considered myself a food blogger, but I did want to get better at food photography. And so I opened an Instagram account called Austin Food Guide. And I just took my camera everywhere I went and photographed the food. And I used that account to post my pictures for practice. And eventually restaurants started hiring me and they didn't realize that they were already following me on Instagram. And so I may have just slipped into food influencing without even intentionally doing so, because I've always just considered myself a food photographer. And now I work primarily with commercial brands, and I do still work with restaurants, but my bread and butter is with commercial work. So it is possible for a food influencer to start influencing and then transition to the commercial world. Never say never on that, but they are two very different worlds. A food influencer is likely to get clients based on the amount of followers that they have. That is what makes them impressive. That is what their calling card is. Mine is the actual work. You see my photos, you see how amazing they are. You want me to do for you what you see on the computer screen. Can you do what's on your website? I want that, but with my brand. So two very, very different worlds. I don't have a massive following. So who am I going to attract, you know, as far as that goes? But definitely when they're looking for a food photographer for their website, for longevity, that's me.
I like that. I always think of things outside of what I have written down. So we're going to jump around, because the thought that I have now is, you know, when you're taking these pictures, you know, you're taking pictures of all kinds of different food. Is there ever this food that's just not photogenic, for a lack of a better word? It's just not working because it's just not a good,
I guess a good medium. I don't know. I feel like not everything has to be photogenic. All people are not, or is all food?
No. And this is a running joke on my show, on my podcast. I talk about this often, about how I absolutely hate photographing chili or any kind of brown food. And obviously people know why, because it just looks like a big pile of poo. And so how do you make something that is naturally not very good looking, how do you make that appealing? And you do that with supporting elements. So chili itself is not that impressive to look at. But when you add in ingredients like chives, or you put some sour cream, you put different things on it to make you go, yeah, or shredded cheddar cheese. Like, there are different things that you style a chili bowl with, and then that makes it look good. And you'll put maybe like a little square of cornbread on the side. You put things that make it look good and support it. Even though the chili is the main star of the show, you put some lipstick on it. You put a nice outfit on and some good shoes and a new haircut. Like, you really fix up chili to make it look good. Otherwise, if you've ever seen just a photo and someone photographs it and they're like, this is chili. I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss on this. It was a meme. And someone posted a photo of, it was like an avocado bowl. It was mashed avocado. And they said, this is like whipped avocado. And someone commented underneath, they're like, that looks like poop. Like, it's not, I don't know what that is. And I remember just laughing so hard, because it really did look like poop. And they didn't know. They're not a photographer, so they didn't know. They just photographed something and they're very proud of it. But now you look at it and it's all you can see. That's the last thing you want with a dish. So it's important to have things that support it and go, oh, that is a bowl of chili. Or like soup. Soup is a very, from top down, you can't really tell what's in the soup. So you're just looking at a bowl and you're like, okay, cool. Cool story, bro. Like, what else? You add in extra elements to support that and say, this is a tomato soup, and you think, okay, there's sour cream, there's cheddar cheese, there's, you know, pepper to break up the red of a tomato soup. Like, there's just different things. But yes, there's so many food that does not look good, but it really depends on who you're catering to. So if you're photographing barbecue, well, to a vegan, that's going to look disgusting and they want nothing to do with it. But to someone who is an avid meat eater and a huge fan of barbecue, they'll see that barbecue and it triggers their memory. And they'll go, oh, yeah, I would love some brisket. That sounds delicious. And that makes their mouth water. But it might not be the best looking thing. It's brown. What can you do with that? So, yeah, there is definitely food that does not look.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm either a aspiring food photographer or somebody who eats too much, because when you were talking about chili and how you make it look good before you said it, I was thinking, yeah, just put like a, you know, a jalapeno next to it or some parsley. So I was thinking, yeah, I was going down that same path. So I like that. I guess I want you to talk about the things that you enjoy most about this profession, and then maybe the things that are not so great.
Well, What I love the most about it is really just being able to create for a living. I mean, there are not a lot of people who can say that they do this, and just having the freedom to be able to do that. On the flip side, is it's a really tough industry to be in. Freelancing in general is tough, but you know, you have to like kind of be a genie and like a fortune teller to see how the next quarter is going to go. And it really does feel like one quarter there's not enough days in the quarter to handle all the shoots that are coming your way. And then the next quarter it's just crickets and you're like, crap, what am I going to do? And so it's definitely a tough industry to be in. You will have to have the utmost faith in yourself and confidence in yourself, because you will face a whole lot of rejection. And so that makes it tough. The love that I have for it, though, is, you know, when it comes to the small mom and pop shops, I see potential in every restaurant that comes my way. And the more local it is, the more smaller it is, the more I just want to like take what I've learned and my skills and do something magical with it and to see it in a way that maybe nobody else has ever seen it. And that excites me. So the creativity and just going wild and crazy. I love when a brand just says, we want to see what your input is. We want your ideas. And I'm like, ooh, don't threaten me with a good time. Like, I just go crazy and think of the most wacky way that we can photograph this. Hard thing about being a photographer really is just being able to talk the business side and saying, these are my rates and sticking by it and standing on business and putting a little, you know, bass in your voice when you are laying boundaries with clients. It can be difficult if that is something that you struggle with, which is something that I definitely struggled with. And, you know, my husband and many mentors have like helped me find my voice. And that's what I meant about wearing like the creative hat and the business hat, because they're two very different souls. And the artist in me is like, this is my art. This is my life. This is my soul. How can I put a price tag on this? And the business side of me is like, I have to. I have to put a price tag on what it takes to create something for you. Those are two things that I still to this day struggle to reconcile. I know there are some people who take to it like fish to water, like it's no biggie. And it really depends on, you know, where, what their background is. I find that a lot of my fellow photographers who came from a business background did not struggle with saying, them the rules, this is what I charge. And it's a yay or nay. But for me, my background has always been as a creative. And so I've always had this deep attachment. Not that my fellow photographers don't have a deep attachment, but I've always been a lot more sensitive about it. So it was hard for me to go, this costs this much and this is my day rate and all of that. But it's either that or I don't eat, or I get taken advantage of, or I take on jobs that I have no business taking on and I'm not making a profit. Those are really hard conversations that I have had with myself over the years, and that, you know, other people have had with me over the years. There's just been a lot of lessons learned along the way.
Yeah, no, I think that's a huge thing. I've heard that from other entrepreneurs before too. And I'm sure you've heard things like this before, but you know, kind of the theme of what people normally say when it comes to that kind of thing and having to create your rates is, you know, you got to create quality pricing in order to get quality customers. So, you know, if you don't charge very much, then you're going to get a lot of customers that aren't that great too. So it's a good little balance. So I think that makes a lot of sense there for sure. What, you know, you talked about how you've done, you know, mom and pops, then you kind of have worked for larger corporations now. With what you can share, you know, I don't know, you know, the how much you've got when it comes to what you can share there, but what's some of the coolest projects you've worked on?
So many, but I'd say the coolest one, and I wouldn't even consider this to be like an actual paid, it wasn't a paid gig. It was when I was in school, I got to photograph a barbecue festival and I was given unlimited access to each vendor and I ate so much barbecue and that was so much fun. And the second assignment I did was for a paella festival, and that was super duper cool. As far as paid work goes, the most fun assignment I ever did was actually for a local honey company. And what I loved about it was that he was so unbothered and he's like, I just want you to like create and then just leave it be. Like, I don't even want to be at the studio. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, thanks so much for this freedom. And, you know, I presented him with the mood board, with the treatment and told him, this is what we're going to do. And he was like, I trust you. And so my team and I just spent two wonderful days creating these beautiful worlds and presenting it to him. And he was just blown away by the end of it, mainly because we presented different worlds of like how you can enjoy honey as a dessert, how you can enjoy it as something savory. And he'd never seen his product used in savory situations. So it was really exciting for him. I will say what my least favorite assignment was, and I can say it because I won't say who the client is, but It was for a chain hotel. They were holding a festival, like a little food event, and they wanted me to photograph the food and photograph the people. And I had like an hour to do it. And it was outside and it was suffering and I was alone. And it was awkward for me to go up to the, I felt like a wedding photographer or like an event photographer. And I was just going up to the guests and I'm like, hi, can I take photos of you awkwardly with your food? No one wants to be photographed eating. Like it's not an appealing thing. You know, you don't want your mouth open. And it's a, when you do photograph people eating, it has to be very staged so they don't look weird and strange. But most of them said, no, we don't want our photo taken. And so, and then towards the end, I was hired for 3 hours and there was one shot that they wanted in particular, like it was the most important shot. And so I went to the event coordinator and I asked her, I told her we have like an hour left, so it's important that we get this shot. And she was like, yeah, in a minute. And then about 15 minutes before I'm supposed to leave, she came to inform me that the important picture that they needed taken wouldn't be happening for another 2 hours. And I said, well, that's a different conversation. That means we're, you know, that's extra outside of our contracted time. So I told them what my rate was for the extra hours. And so they're like, oh, well, we don't want to do that. And so we had to stage the event and I had less than 10 minutes to, they went and gathered a group of employees who just wanted to go to the event. They went to the event and unfortunately those employees, they got a little toasted. And so they're like, these are going to be your models. And I'm like, great. So I have 10 minutes to wrangle these intoxicated people and get the shots that they want. And I did it and it wrapped up and I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And I was like, never again. And it was just a really disappointing situation because, you know, I didn't make a profit off of it and it wasn't, they got more out of it than I did. But, and I didn't get to eat any of the food. I was so upset. I was like, what? How are you going to have me at this event? And then I don't get to eat anything. Like, at least I would have had that. But I look at those photos. They were happy with the photos and how they turned out. And they did invite me to come photograph another event. And I was like, no, I'm busy. I can't do that. But I was like, never again, ever again. Middle of summer, Texas, like 100 plus, degree temperature. Nah. Never again.
Yeah. Well, just like, you know, just like bad photos, I feel like people, you're going to remember the ones that cause you the most problems. So yeah, I that would be, in my world, that would be a torture to be photographing all this food and not be able to eat any of it. But I feel like you're probably getting used to it a little bit. You're around food a lot more than I am. So I guess I want to ask you a little bit about, because, you know, you're talking about the business side of things and the artsy side of things. I mean, my degrees are in business, so I'm always thinking the business side of things. I just wonder, given that you know, if you're at one point you were creating photography for menus, so that's obviously kind of making it look good and making it look good potentially on a plate. So in my mind, I'm thinking, if I had a restaurant, I would hire a food photographer to take these pictures, and then they're going to double as somebody who's going to teach me how to elegantly plate this thing. And that way I know exactly how to make it look presentable from here on out. How often do people give you things in a way that doesn't look good? You create a new plating and then you notice that they've started doing that.
Well, I wish that I could take credit for a lot of the plating. The facts are, often I do work with a food stylist. And so whenever I present a bid to a restaurant or to a food brand, especially small brands, I fight for my life justifying the cost for hiring a food stylist. And my argument is, look, you're paying me a lot of money and my job is to be the photographer. But if I'm doing two jobs, it will distract me. It will take me away from what I do best. So yes, chefs do, restaurants do. They do listen and watch the stylists do their magic, but it's often not me. And I learn from the food stylist. I mean, everything that I know about styling, I learned from a food stylist. And yes, I looked at food photos and I saw, oh, well, this looks good. This looks good. This looks good. But it's really the food stylist who know how to break down a dish and know how to make it look appealing and delicious and wonderful. My mastery, my skills and expertise are in the lighting, are in the technical side of how to make something look good. I mean, that's literally the root word of photography comes from photon, which is the study of light. So that's where my expertise is. But a food stylist, oftentimes their background is in cooking as a chef. Either they went to culinary school or they've just been cooking their entire lives. So they know how to make something look amazing and wonderful. If there's ever a commercial dish that you see, a cookbook that you see, even actual video commercials, that's been styled by a food stylist. So I give all the credit to them. I bow my head and hands down to how wonderful they are. So yeah, it's not me that they recreate. It's the food stylist that they do.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And you know, you talked earlier about kind of the sorcery of the world of food photography. I guess I kind of want to hear a little bit behind the scenes. You know, I've heard, you know, with food photography, obviously sometimes you see a burger in a picture and it winds up being a third of the size of that picture because, you know, they've got a piece of styrofoam in the middle, or, you know, you've got a drink that really they, you know, obviously ice melts pretty fast. So you've got glass in the glass instead. What kind of tricks are done to make things actually look really good?
Well, before I answer that question, I want to make it clear that there are laws when it comes to food photography. We are required by law to use the real product of whatever the brand is. So if it's a, let's say, oatmeal brand, then we are photographing real oatmeal, and everything else can be manipulated, but the oatmeal itself has to be oatmeal. And it's just an ethical law. And I get it. And I have no qualms or whatsoever about it. If it's a pizza company, well, we need to use their pizzas. We have to. We can't manipulate those pizzas in any way. But there are a lot of cool things that you can do with other things. So if, like, for example, we've used fake mashed potatoes if we're photographing meatloaf. You don't need to go and waste a bunch of potatoes for mashed potatoes. You can use fake mashed potatoes. Cookbooks, everything is real. We don't fake anything when it comes to cookbooks. And that's just, again, ethical, required by law. The whole book is the product. But also, it's the process of, like, how you get to a recipe. It's more on a commercial set that you'll find that things are kind of tricked with and messed with. But there are ways of that we do make something look fresher. So maybe we'll spray a little bit of olive oil on lettuce leaves to give them a little bit of a shine. Or burger patty, we won't cook it all the way. We'll sear the outside so that it retains its shape, because meat does shrink when it's cooked fully. Fries, same thing, won't cook it all the way. I have not worked on a set where we used motor oil for syrup, so I don't know where that came from, but we've never done that. But I mean, there's just lots of little tricks that you can use, like creating lifts so you can see things a little bit more clearly, using other ingredients to bring out more colors of the dish itself, how it's styled, how it's cut. Those are all things that are done on set. But it's the bigger commercial sets that things will definitely be weird and wacky with. Yeah.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, I mean, the other thing too, and this is not a question that I would have had, you know, I would have thought of myself, but I saw that you had written it down. So it piqued my curiosity. And that is, you know, the ChatGPT, AI, that kind of stuff has kind of changed the world of food photography and the way that you do things too. What's that all about?
Well, I know this is a sensitive topic within the photography community. Me personally, I am not worried. I've embraced it, and I was pretty much an early adopter of it. I do use it for helping me write out my treatments. It just helps me clarify my ideas. But as far as, like, creating generative images, I don't use it for that. I do use it to convert my hand drawings into the shot that I'm really thinking of. And I'm very detailed in my prompt about where the light's coming from, the camera shutter speed, the everything. Like, it's very detailed prompt. And so when I present the shot list to the client and they see what the shot's going to look like, it looks like a drawing. I need it to be a drawing, because I don't want the client to be like, oh, well, this looks good. Why don't we just use this image? And so I show the client, this is what we're going to create. This is exactly what you're going to get. And it's wonderful because I'm not a drawer. I can't draw. You get stick figures with me. And so it's hard to translate my ideas with stick figures as opposed to this very well-drawn, beautiful shot. It gets them so jazzed and excited. But as far as like feeling like I'm going to be replaced by AI, I don't worry about it. And I'll say this, because a friend of mine who's not a photographer, a friend of mine was so scared. And she's like, I think it's freaky that people can create something. You're not worried at all? I said, no. And I go, okay, let's do this. We have a little challenge that we're going to do. I told her to input an apple, and I would input an apple too for a prompt. And we would create two different images of an apple using AI. And her image just looked like an apple and special, nothing wonderful. While mine looked very artsy fartsy, it's exactly what I wanted it to look like because of what I input. And it just drove home the idea that it is still the creator who can determine how an image will look. That's what I'm hired for. There are so many photographers here who have the same skills that I have, who have the same knowledge of around a camera that I do. But what makes me different from that photographer is what I see in my head, what I envision, what fuels me as an artist. And that's just not something that can be replicated. It can be if you put in a prompt, but it really is the person putting in the prompt that determines what something will look like. So while one person's putting an apple in a kitchen, well, that's so vague. There are so many kitchens out there. You're giving AI this very vast prompt, vague prompt, not vast, but vague prompt of a kitchen. Okay, well, what kind of kitchen? Okay, well, is it an open kitchen? Is it a well-lit kitchen? Are there windows? If there are windows, what kind of windows? Is this light coming in? Where is the light coming in from? What's in the kitchen? Is it a bowl? What kind of bowl? What's the color of the bowl? I mean, those are things that the average person doesn't think of. But the creator, like me, like another photographer, that is what makes us so brilliant. So I like AI because I can use it as a tool. It's not going to replace me. What will replace me is me not willing to embrace something. It's going to be someone who is going to use the tool. Just like when film photography, digital photography was introduced, there was like an identity crisis in the photography community. And in this case, I don't consider people who use AI, generative AI, I don't consider them to be photographers, because again, photography is the study of light, photon, study of light. And when you're creating an image on AI, you're not studying light, you're just creating an image. So you're an image creator, you're a content creator or something like that. So I don't feel fear. I feel like we need to use it. I feel like we need to embrace it and get a hold of it now, because it is kind of the wild, wild west right now. And I know there's going to be a lawsuit. It's not a matter of when or if, it's a matter of when, especially in the food photography world. I have seen some restaurants use AI to promote their restaurant. And I'm like, ooh, you are walking on dangerous water. That is a lawsuit waiting to happen. But until that happens, there's just kind of uncharted waters. We really don't know what the rules are. We're kind of figuring that out right now.
Yeah. No, I mean, I work in the world of higher education. So obviously we've had to figure that out and how to, you know, try to harness it as well. So I completely understand that for sure. In kind of wrapping things up, because I really think I could just ask you random questions till morning. So in wrapping things up, you know, you already talked a little bit about, you know, a episode you had on your podcast. Tell us a little bit about that podcast and how people can check it out.
Yes, wonderful. So I host a podcast called The Savory Shot, and it's about the art and soul of working in food photography. I interview people that are in the industry. I also interview people that support the industry. And what I mean by supporting, I mean business coaches, I mean accountants and people that help us keep doing what we do. Really, I am more interested about the person and their story because I feel like events that have happened in your life are lessons for other people. And the reason why I started the Savory Shot was, A, it was lonely getting into the freelance world. It felt like there was a lot of gatekeeping. It's changed a lot, but I just didn't know anything about anything. And I found myself in situations where I was taken advantage of. My art was taken advantage of, and I took on gigs that the client was getting a steal of a deal, but I wasn't getting anything out of it. And it took me asking questions to the people that had been in the industry for 10 plus years, who have been there, done that, could offer advice to people who were getting into the industry and advice. And it was just real conversations. I don't want glossy and now we're successful stories. Like, I'm like, this is your chance to trauma dump on us. Give me the story. But it's just been such a wonderful experience. The podcast has been around now for about 2 years, and I've met so many wonderful stylists and photographers, and it's just great to have a genuine conversation about not just the business side of it, but like in tune with yourself, your soul. So we do talk a lot about photography, but that isn't the only thing we talk about. It really is just about how you are the way you are. What I find so fascinating about the world of photography and being a freelancer is how so many people from different backgrounds find their way into this industry. One photographer used to be an architect. She came from the business world. One started like right away. She always knew she wanted to be a photographer. One was a waitress. They said, heck no, I don't want to go to college. I just want to be a photographer. And they just hit the ground running. My background getting into photography was so winding, and there was a lot of dippets and a lot of, you know, little turning on side streets. Like, it wasn't just one long path that got me here. And it's the same way with everybody else that are in the industry. So that's mainly what we talk about. It's just me asking questions. I want to know you. You're my bestie when I talk to you. So it's a great show.
No, it sounds awesome. And, you know, podcasts are so easy to find. It's almost a silly question to ask, but how can people find it?
Well, we are on Spotify, we're on Apple Podcast, and of course, you can find us on Instagram. So my Instagram is my name, Mika, MICA.McCook. And then my podcast is the Savory Shot Podcast on Instagram. And yeah, it's a great little community. We are a small but mighty community of photographers, and anyone, you don't have to be a photographer to listen to it. It really is just a lot of different worlds that come together, and they just want to hear about people's journeys and struggles. And I appreciate my guests being so willing to be vulnerable with me, because I do ask some pretty deep questions and we do get deep in the conversation. And it only is possible because they're willing to trust me to ask these questions. And we create such a safe space for us to talk about these things. And so I try to make it the same way on Instagram.
I love it. And I urge people to check that out for sure. No, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
So that was Mika McCook. Really great conversation. As always, I learned a ton. You know, I'm a big fan of food. We talked a little bit just about, I guess maybe I could be a food photographer myself. You know, I've got at least the vision, but I don't think I've got the skill. But I've always really enjoyed, you know, the culture around food and sharing meals with new people and that kind of thing. So I really like kind of what Mika had to say around that, and just the vision that she has when it comes to taking pictures of it, to make sure that all of that is conveyed. Really, really awesome conversation. Urge you to check out all of her social media. All of that will be in the show notes. Follow along with her. Great, great pictures. Sure to make you hungry. But follow along with her. If this is your first time listening, you haven't already, just like I said in the beginning, follow along on Instagram, on TikTok, Not Enough Podcast, on Facebook, Not Enough with Jackson Huff, on Spotify and Apple. Leave a 5-star rating and a written review on Apple. That helps a ton. But we'll see you next time. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think. Or, hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.